Turn with me, if you will, to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Look at verse 6. Godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Let me ask a question or two. Damien, when you get 16, do you want a car?
Yes.
You want a car, okay. How about you, John Michael? Would you like to have a car or a pickup truck?
Yes, sir.
You have one now?
I have one car. Yes.
But you'd like to have what? Something different? No, you satisfied with what you got? Oh, okay. I thought you said you wanted one. What about you, Danny?
Yes, sir.
Do, okay. Noah?
Yes.
You get out and go to work. Do you want to get a good job that pays well?
Yes.
Okay. Riker? Is there anything you'd like to have that you don't have? No? So you don't want anything for Christmas or nothing, right? Good. Now, your mom and dad heard that, so in good shape. Contentment. What is contentment? So, Damien wants a car someday. I imagine Chad closer to wanting one someday. Danny wants a car someday. And Noah would like to find a good paying job someday. Does that mean they don't practice contentment, that that's not a character trait? Let me ask this question, and you don't have to answer. The men in this audience, would you like to have a raise? Would you like to make a little more money? And if you would, I'm not going to ask because I don't want you to have to be dishonest. If you would, does that mean you're not content? So here's a passage that talks about contentment. We're talking about this as a basic character trait. You're going to find a number of different definitions in the dictionary for contentment. It occurs in this text. What's the best way to understand what Paul meant when he told Timothy that godliness with contentment is great gain? What's the best way to interpret what he meant? The context. That's right. So let's do that. In verse 5. So we read verse 6. We'll back up one verse. Let me go back up to verse 3. You pick up from there. If a man advocates a different doctrine. So here's somebody that's contending for some doctrine. Maybe it's a teacher or a preacher. And he says at verse 5, these kind of men who are depraved in mind and deprived of the truth suppose that godliness is a means of gain. What kind of gain would a teacher be looking for?
Popularity.
Huh?
Popularity, praise.
Popularity, praise, maybe so.
Money.
Oftentimes, there's money as a desire. We don't know anything about preachers today that preach for that reason, do we? Some of the wealthiest men on this earth are preachers. My wife looked it up the other day. I was amazed myself. Men like Joel Osteen. Some of the richest preachers over in where? Nigeria? I'm talking about millions and millions of dollars they're worth. I'm not talking about 500,000. Millions of dollars. And people use certain doctrines and preaching and religious things to get rich, get money. And so back in the first century, you had that same kind of thing. Means of great gain. The Pharisees, who were the teachers of the law, when they came to believe that Jesus was the Christ, they would not confess it. Do you remember why? Might be put out of the synagogue. And so what? Their power and their income. They were supported. And Jesus talks about them being lovers of money. And so there's nothing wrong with having money. In fact, think with me just a minute. Who were some of the richest and yet most godly men in the Bible? You think of some?
Abraham.
Rich, rich man. Who?
Solomon,
right? You reckon David was okay? Had to worry about his bank account? Right? And Timothy, here in Timothy, down in verse 17, there were rich people in the church at Ephesus. There's been a number of rich men in the Bible that are good and godly men. There's nothing wrong with having riches. So when you talk about contentment, it's not talking about having a 600 square foot house and be satisfied. Otherwise, you're not content. You may not be, but that's not the measure of it. So here we talk about teaching something for gain. Well, let's drop down to verse 7. So he says, godliness with contentment is great gain. All right, verse 7. We have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But, now, you have the statement in verse 6 and the statement in verse 8 about contentment. Now you have a contrast. And one of the ways to define words in the Bible is by contrast. See what the contrast is. So here's the contrast. Those who want to get rich. This is not signing up for Publishers Clearing House and someday thinking maybe a check will come. That's not this. It's longing to get rich. They think about it. They work at it. They sacrifice for it. It's the desire of their lives. They've got a fine house, maybe a pretty nice chariot, maybe an animal to ride on, but they want more. They want to get rich. And that defines their priorities. They want to get rich. And because of that, they fall into temptation and a snare, many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. These pyramid schemes, when they appeal to people, want to hire people to go to work for them. It's the appeal to get rich that they use. Man, you won't have to get up till 10 o'clock in the morning. You'll have millions of dollars. You can help your church. You can do all kind of stuff. And that's a great appeal to people. We'll talk a little bit of it in a minute, the danger accompanied with it. Note verse 10, the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some by, look at this word, longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang. You have that, but then you have in verse 17, people who are rich. So it's not having money or things. It's an attitude about them. Either the things you have or the things you don't have, but would like to possess. We put on your lesson an attitude of peace, ease and satisfaction in one's circumstances that provides equilibrium, a balance in your life, whether rich or middle class or poor. And then I put it's the opposite of, that's what we did when started verse 8 with the but. It's the opposite of even desiring more and spending time and effort to acquire what one does not have. How How many houses did the Apostle Paul own? I don't know if he owned any. How about his chariot? He traveled a lot. Wouldn't a nice chariot have been nice? I don't know if he owned any. How about a donkey? I don't know if he owned any. In fact, to support himself, what did he have to do? What? Tent making? Just 8 hours a day? What did he say about his work? He worked day and night to provide for himself and the others with him. And still preached. And so, here let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 10. Can a guy like that be content? How can you be content when you don't have transportation? You don't own a piece of property, or at least we don't know if he did. We'll see, in fact, how can you be content when you're in prison? But nevertheless, here's a key to this man's attitude and a key to having this character trait of being content with where we're at. And the beauty part of it is, if you're a Christian, if you believe the Bible, if you believe God's promises, it doesn't make any difference what economic status you are, or what your health is, or what the government situation is. Boy, we're in tumult about our government right now. You can still be content. Because the things that you find in this verse that bring that sense of peace and ease and satisfaction are things that are not dependent on finances and health and the government. Let's read it together. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 10. As sorrowful. Was Paul ever sorrowful? What was he? Tell me some things he might be sorrowful about.
He was sorrowful when he had to write to the Corinthian brethren that someone
had not. That's right. When he wrote to the Corinthian brethren, he said in the second letter, I wrote it with tears. You reckon he was sorrowful when they arrested him and started beating him? You reckon he was sorrowful when they started throwing stones at him in Lystra? You think he was sorrowful when people he had worked with left the faith, like Demas? That's sorrowful. But look, that didn't control his thinking and his life. Listen, he said, as sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. Tell me when you read that, which letter do you think about that Paul wrote? Philippians. He's in prison. He's chained to a guard. He has no freedom. He don't know when he's going to get out. He's waiting on his appeal to the emperor. But the key to that book is rejoice in the Lord over and over and over again. All these other things are peripheral. It'd have been nice to be out and be free and have money. But that didn't keep him from rejoicing. There's that equilibrium that we're talking about. Look again. He said, as poor, we've been talking about, he's poor, yet making many rich. How can a poor man make people rich? Well, again, it's that sense of what's valuable. He was giving people the most valuable gift they would ever receive. And that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. As poor and making many rich. As having nothing and yet possessing all things. Now, if we can imbibe that attitude, and it's not something you push a button and do, it's a way of thinking about the spiritual treasures, about what God has provided and what's really important. What's lasting, that we can have contentment in whatever state we might find ourselves. Back in 1 Timothy 6 again.
Steve?
Yes?
What's the all things there mean?
Okay. That means having chariots and a house and some property, right?
I won't figure so, but I'm sure there's some
All things that mean anything, that are important. Everything he needed to his spiritual welfare, his relationship with God, is all that it can mean. Isn't it? He didn't have all things materially. He didn't have freedom a lot of times. He didn't. How about his health? What do you say he had in 2 Corinthians 12? Thorn in the flesh. What do you think when he got dressed in the morning, if he had a mirror, and looked in the mirror at his back, that he saw?
Stripes.
You bet. And so, having all things. Good health? Not perfect health, for sure. No. And so, you just look at Paul's life and what's important to him. We'll read some more verses. A lot. Good question, Josh. We'll look at some more verses here in just a second. But look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. So he tells Timothy, don't be always worrying about making money, making more money, making more money. Now, Paul worked to make money, to feed himself and those who were with him. But his aim was not money. Getting food and clothing was a means to an end. Now look down at verse 11. Flee from these things, you man of God. This word flee from these things. We get our word fugitive from it. Stay away from it. They're dangerous. He said, and pursue. Here's the opposite. So, if you're not to pursue those things, you're to pursue these things. That means this is where you spend your time. This is what you think about. This is what you talk about. You remember a story Jesus told about covetousness? Luke chapter 12. When he talked about covetousness, in that chapter, did he talk about taking what belongs to somebody else? No. In the Ten Commandments, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, property, etc. But that's not Luke 12. And yet Jesus talked about covetousness. What was the man's problem?
Hoarding.
Huh?
Hoarding.
Hoarding? Is it wrong to have a lot of money in the bank? If you think it is, I'll give you my bank account. You can send it to me if you want to. All the man could talk about, all of his efforts, all of his time. Here's what I'll do. I'll build bigger barns and I'll store all my goods there and I'll say to my soul, eat, drink, and be merry. It's all about things. God said you're going to die bankrupt. What about your soul? So here, pursue. Pursue what? Not bigger barns, bigger house, a finer car, and a lot of money. What do you pursue? Righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. Now, when he said pursue those things, if somebody was to try to educate you, say, pursue money, what would that demand to pursue money or getting rich? Time, effort, thought. You don't pursue money by saying, boy, I'd like to get rich. I'm waiting for it to fall from heaven. You have to think about it. How am I going to get it? Where am I going to spend my time? How am I going to work for it? What's my plan? Well, if that's what it means to pursue riches, what does it mean to pursue these things? Think about it now and then. Pursue. Work on it. Think about it. Talk about it. There's the difference. All right. Let's go to Ephesians. This kind of works on Josh's point when he said possessing all things. Whenever you read all things in the Bible, by the way, I'll just make a side point that's going to be valuable in your Bible study. All is not universal. All meaning everything you can think of. All is defined by the context. All things work together for good to them that love the Lord. Romans chapter 8. Passage has been sorely abused. A big Mack truck runs over your kid. You say, well, all things work together for good. No, that's not that chapter. And so when you read all things, always remember the context. All right, so here we are in Ephesians chapter 1, written by the same fellow who wrote 2 Corinthians 6. This time, where is he at? In Rome, and where in Rome? In prison. He's in prison. And look what he says here in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 3. Blessed be. What does blessed be God mean?
Praise God.
Praise and thanksgiving and glory be given to God. For what? Who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ. Every spiritual blessing. Now, let's go to chapter 3. In chapter 1, he starts talking about these blessings. He talks about he chose us, verse 4. He predestined us, verse 5. He gave us redemption and forgiveness, verse 7. He made known the mystery of his will in verse 9. We have obtained an inheritance in verse 11. Verse 13, we were sealed. He just goes on and on. Chapter 2, he said you were dead. He made you alive. Chapter 2, he said you were far away. He brought you near. Now you have access to his throne. Chapter 3, he says you have an inheritance. He's just been going on and on and on. Now he says in chapter 3, verse 8, to me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentile. You remember he said, poor but making many rich? Look, to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches. What does unfathomable mean? What? Okay, it can be unending. If you go out on an ocean and they want to tell you how deep the water is that not one way they measure it? What if they say, I don't have an instrument that I can go to the bottom? It's too deep. It's unfathomable. It cannot be measured. That's what he's saying about the riches of Christ. The unfathomable, you may say unsearchable, riches of Christ. And to bring to light what is the administration of the mystery which for ages had been hidden in God. Paul was poor, but he felt he was the richest man on earth, and he could make other people rich. What an attitude. And so in chapter 3 and verse 13, he said, I ask you not to lose heart at my tribulation on your behalf or there for your glory. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father. So here he is. He's in prison. Don't worry about my tribulation. He said, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, that he would grant you according to the riches of his glory to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man. So how is this strength going to come? Here, listen to it. So that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. Christ the person, is he leaving heaven and going to come down and go through your ear and jump inside your body? Is that what it is? What does it mean, Christ dwell in your hearts?
The word of grace.
The gospel of Christ. That's right, the word of grace. That Christ may dwell in your hearts. That you'll understand all these things you've been talking about in these three chapters. May dwell. Dwell is to rule, to control, to dwell in your hearts through faith. And that you being rooted and grounded in love, God's love for you in Christ, that you're rooted and grounded in that, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth and to know the love of Christ. It's Christ's love that he's talking about, which surpasses knowledge. That will give you strength. That'll give you strength when they put you in prison, not even attended to your wounds that you suffered at beating. That'll give you strength when you're fixing to face death in prison and you know it. You don't have anything and yet you're rich. That's the state of mind that Paul talks about. And so having all things, unless I'm mistaken, Josh, that's what he would be talking about. Everything that's of value, of importance, that's lasting. You know, 2 Corinthians 4, he talked about why he didn't get discouraged. Because he's not looking at the outer man. He's looking at the eternal. Not the temporal, but the eternal. And the house that's not made with hands that he was going to receive. All right, look at Philippians chapter 4. We talk about contentment. Can we learn this basic trait? Can we train ourselves to have this attitude? Philippians 4:11. Not that I speak from want. Tell me again where he's at? In prison. Not that I speak from want. I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, but look at that next sentence. Andy says, I also know how to live in prosperity. You can be prosperous and not content. What do you often read about rich people? For example, movie actors who've got all the money in the world and fame. How do they die oftentimes? What?
Suicide.
Suicide. What? You got more money than we'll make in 10 lifetimes. Famous, but not content. So being rich doesn't mean you're going to be content. We'll read a verse in Ecclesiastes if I quit talking and get to it. But he said, I've learned how to get along in both circumstances, in any and every circumstance. I've learned the secret of being filled and going hungry. Both of having abundance and suffering need. There were evidently times in Paul's life when he was in great shape. In fact, based on the gift that they sent him, it really changed his circumstances. Well, Paul, would you please tell us the secret? If you've learned the secret, would you tell us? He tells you in verse 13. I can do. There's one of those phrases, by the way. All things. Why, I can jump over tall buildings. I can go through the jail cell without anybody seeing me. No. I can deal with every circumstance that comes my way, whether it's good or bad, through Jesus Christ. And he didn't just write about it, talk about it. He demonstrated it. That's what contentment will do. Look at Ecclesiastes 5. You know, the book of Ecclesiastes doesn't even focus on heaven, and yet it advocates contentment with your circumstances. When people are not content, here's what happened. Looks in chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. Do you believe that's correct? Look at rich men in your society. They've got billions of dollars. You think they'll live long enough to spend them? No. Are they satisfied? Say, okay, I'm going to quit making money. No. They're going to keep making money. There's a series that came on the History Channel. A lot of stuff on the History Channel is not reliable, but it was interesting, nevertheless. It's about the men who made America. And there were two or three real famous, powerful men. Like Andrew Carnegie, Rockefeller, etc. Guys were wealthy, but they wanted to be number one. They wanted more than the other guy. And that's what he said back here. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what's the advantage of their owners except to look on? After a while, you got so much money, what else can it do for you? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he's little or much. The stomach, full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. He's worried about somebody stealing him. What's going to happen to the stock market? How's he going to make more money? Those bigger barns he can build? There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When they're lost through a bad investment, his father or son, there's nothing to support him. You can lose it all, and that happens. It can rob one of health and happiness. He keeps on talking about that there in verse 12. Keep you from having a peaceful life and sleeping. In verse 15, as he came naked from his mother's womb, so he returned as he came. He'll take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. Remember, when you die, you leave it all behind. Here's a grievous evil. He's not talking about evil sin. It's a bad thing. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So, you spend your lifetime accumulating money and things and houses and cars and you die, what happens? Alex used a phrase, he said somebody told him, you've never seen a hearse pull into a U-Haul trailer. You don't take it with you. It's gone. And so he said, it's like toiling for the wind, trying to grab the wind, put it in your pocket. You can't. Throughout his life, he eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. People spend their whole lives about money and accumulation. And well, go over to chapter 6. Besides his health, look what happens. I don't have time to read all 9 verses. But what he's talking about, here's a man. Verse 2, he's been given riches and wealth and honor. He lacks nothing his soul desires. But God doesn't let him eat from them. And eat from them doesn't mean sitting at the table and cutting a piece of pie. It means enjoy them. For a foreigner enjoys them. See? The contrast? That's how you know. A foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity. So he's got all this stuff, but he never enjoys it. Well, maybe he needs a bigger family and more time. So he says, okay, give him 100 children. He lives many years. His soul is not satisfied. Look at verse 3, the end of the verse. Better the miscarriage than he. It'd been better to be born dead. That way you skip all the heartache. He's going to die anyway. You skip all the heartache in life. You get to the end. Look down at verse 6. Wait, we'll give him some more time. The other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not what, do what? Enjoy good things. Do not all go to one place. Everybody go to the same place. The grave. In this book. That's it. The grave. So, verse 7, all a man's labor is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. What advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have, knowing how to walk before the living? Here it is, verse 9. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. You got it. Enjoy it. It may not be what the next guy's got, but enjoy it. Now, when you want to talk about spiritual priorities, there's that passage over in Luke 12. I'm not going to read it. You're familiar with it. The rich man, he'd spent all his time building his barns. God said, tonight your soul's required. Now, who's going to own all that stuff? And in that text, Jesus said, the important thing is the kingdom of heaven. I'm going to quote a verse. You tell me if I quote it right. Seek the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Wrong. What's wrong with that? First. Is that time? Priority. Priority. That's what's wrong with this guy. So, look at all through this book, he talks about how to live. Look in chapter 3, verse 22. Nothing is better than a man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. Look in chapter 5, verse 18. What I've seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all his labor, in which he toils under the sun the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he's empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. So whether you're middle class or whether you're rich, enjoy whatever God gives you. He says it's a gift to God. That's what he advocates all through this book. Look over, if you will, in chapter 9. Well, chapter 6, verse 9. I read that a while ago, so let me look at that one first. What the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. Now look at chapter 9. Look at chapter 9, verse 7. Go, eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, that is rejoicing, not always mourning and what you don't have and looking at the bad things. And let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he's given you under their son, for this is your reward in life. You know, there's people that don't enjoy their marriage because all their time and energy spent making more money so they can have a nicer car and a bigger house and a boat and retirement, which they may not live to see. Why not be content and enjoy life? In the Song of Solomon, here's a story about the Shulamite maiden. She could be in the king's harem, have all that anybody could possibly want. Or there's this shepherd boy that she's in love with. He can't give her a castle and he can't give her real fancy beds. Who's she going to go with? Look at chapter 7. Verse 10. This is in her mind as she thinks about it. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. And this is what she envisions him saying. Come, my beloved. Let us go out into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early and go to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine has budded and its blossoms have opened, whether the pomegranates have bloomed. There I will give you my love. You reckon Solomon had time to run through the fields and look at the pomegranates? No. In other words, this boy said, let's spend life together. Let's just enjoy what God's given us. Over in chapter 8, verse 6, when she has made her decision, she says, verse 6, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. And jealousy, or you'll note the footnote, which I prefer there, its ardor is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, he'd be utterly despised. You can't buy this kind of love. This is the affectionate love between a husband and wife. Buying a bigger car and a bigger house won't get it. It's time, it's thought, it's attention. You got this wonderful thing that God's made for you, called a helper, a mate, somebody designed to help you with your life. Enjoy her. And if you're the woman on the other side, you got this man who you can spend time with. Enjoy the time you have. Unfortunately, some are content with spiritual immaturity, ignorance, and laziness. Matthew 25:26, what is that man condemned for? Murder, stealing, lying, what?
Lazy.
He's lazy. Did he mean he did nothing? What did he do with what his master gave him?
Buried it.
You think that takes some work? A lazy person doesn't do what they ought to do. In Hebrews 5, you remember that passage? What did the Hebrew writer reprove those readers for? Not doing what? Not advancing in knowledge. So as they said, you ought to be teachers by now. You're still feeding on the milk. You're lazy. You hadn't applied yourself. You're content with what you already knew. That's not good. In Revelation 3, you have the church at Laodicea. They were really proud of themselves. He said, you're lukewarm, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. And in Philippians 3, Paul encourages people to keep pressing on. That's what he's doing. to the life that fits the resurrected life of Jesus Christ. I want to look at our suggestion discussion points. Should children and young people expect to have what their siblings have? Young people in our audience, if you want to answer, if you don't, okay. At least think about this. If here's Danny and John Michael, for example. If John Michael gets a brand new phone, does Danny think he ought to get a new phone? If Michael and Amy decide to buy John Michael a new truck, does that mean Danny thinks they ought to buy him something? You know, here's Damien and Chad. So, Chad, you're 14. How old are you, Damien? 12. So, let's suppose Lisa says, okay, Chad, you're 14. You can stay up till 11 o'clock. I mean, Chad. Get your names turned around here. But she says, Damien, I want you to go to bed at 10 o'clock. How should Damien feel? In rivalry, there's often this lack of contentment. But where can they learn it? Who are they learning about contentment from? Parents. I've seen young married people. They're up to their nose in debt. Because mom and dad got a big TV, we ought to have a big TV. Mom and daddy go take trips, we ought to be able to take trips. Mom and daddy eat out, we ought to be able to eat out. So where are you going to start teaching contentment? Let them see it in your lives and teach it to your children. And if they don't learn it at home, where are they going to learn it? Craig Otterback's not here. I was going to ask him a question. Maybe you can answer it, Jamie. If not, I know Wally can. When Craig was in college, what kind of car did he drive? An old van. Had to take water for it because it might radiator might leak. Oh, what was his dad just poverty stricken or something? Could buy him something better? No. What did Eric drive? Another bomb.
They all drove a gray station wagon. They all drove that.
Yeah. And Wally and Linda taught them something about being content. And so, you can teach by the things you do at home about contentment. And so I forgot here, what are the potential pitfalls as they grow older? They may not be content with their job. They're ever always angling and unhappy because that guy's got more money. Now, he got an advancement I didn't. About their family, again, getting in debt, those kind of things, buying beyond their means. And all of that, then working two jobs and three jobs so I can make more money and I don't have time for my family. I don't have time for Bible study. Where is that going to catch up with you? Catch up with you not only in your health, but in your spiritual well-being and in your family. Contentment, a basic character trait that has so much, so many ramifications. Anybody want to make a comment before I close the class? Got one more lesson on basic character traits. We were going to be out of time. I wasn't going to get to it. But since we decided to keep meeting for the next quarter, we've got the lesson in the back, and you can pick it up. And next Wednesday night will be the last. It'll be 13 lessons on character traits. When we're finished with the class, I'll send Wally the updated version. I also have a teacher's edition if you're interested in it, which has a lot of notes in it. You'd probably want to add to it if you were using it. But at least it's a starter. So just remember those are available.